No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So call in with your comments at 888-627-6008, or you can Skype us at BBSRADIOPR, and we'd love to hear from you. Maria is out on travel this week. I think she's in Abu Dhabi. It's hard to keep track of this woman. She's all over the place. But we're lucky enough tonight to have a very special guest with us, Dan Vallone. And Dan works for a group called More in Common. And as you probably know from listening to our show, this is really what Shadow Politics is all about. It's about bringing people together to discuss issues so that we can reach some kind of consensus, because we don't like the way things are going in our society with everybody being so divided. So it's great to have Dan here. And let me tell you a little bit about Dan. We're really honored to have him here, because before he was with More in Common USA, Dan worked on educational policy and innovation at the state and national level. He served as an infantry officer with 1 tour in Afghanistan. He's a graduate of West Point. He has an MA Nanyang, I believe it's called, Technical University in Singapore, where he was a Fulbright scholar, and an MBA from Harvard Business School. Oh my God, Dan, how have you accomplished so much at such a young age? Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Senator Brown. Really appreciate it. And I really admire that you're taking this topic on in such a profound way. And I'm very grateful to be here. So thank you.
Well, you know what? I got to tell you, I think that just reading your brief bio, you must be an amazing person. My brother was an instructor at the Air Force Academy. And when I was in college, I used to go out there, and I couldn't believe what those guys went through. And to be a graduate of West Point is amazing in itself, not to mention Harvard Business School. So let's start by doing what I was trained to do as a child, and thank you for your service to America. We really appreciate that, Dan. You know, I come from a military family, so thank you so much for your service. And thanks for being on our show tonight. And let's start. Since your organization, tell me about your organization. That's the first thing. What are the goals of your organization?
Sure. So More in Common is an interesting organization. We're very new. We launched in 2017, and we work in the U.S., U.K., France, and Germany, basically to study why societies fall apart, and then to try and build and support partners in bringing people together across lines of division. And so we do a lot of research. Our specialty in research is we do very large national surveys where, rather than just focus on conventional demographic or ideological categories, we actually apply a unique research methodology to try and surface underlying value systems and beliefs that are kind of driving a lot of what we see as the division in our respective societies. But by understanding these underlying values and beliefs a little bit better, we actually start to see more space for common ground. And I think that it's it's been really interesting to research and to study in all of these different democracies and see how much there actually is in common, both with respect to how these societies are seeming to be so divided and also where we have things that are a little unexpectedly in common and what values we share with others.
Well, I've got to tell you that I think that this is a real problem in the Democratic Party. I've been a Democrat for 40 years, and I think one of the things that they don't get is what those underlying values are. And I think it's really, really hurt us as a political party. We keep on focusing, for example, on President Trump, when we really should be focusing, I believe, on the things that you're talking, you know, that you're researching. Why, you know, how is it that so many people support this man, even if it's only 30, even if his popularity is only 36%? There are issues out there that I think we're just not getting as Democrats. And what are you finding? Are you finding that that's true? Are there some issues that are common to the to people, working class people, for example, in the United States that we're just not understanding?
The short answer is, well, I don't want to say we as in the Democratic Party per se is an understanding. I would say that as a society, what we see and what our research shows is that on either end of the spectrum, so on the left, the Democrats, on the right, the Republicans, you do have a much more narrow base. You know, when we did our study in the U.S., we published it in 2018 called The Hidden Tribes, the Study of America's Polarized Landscape. We identified three groups, progressive activists on the left and traditional and devoted conservatives on the right. And what those groups share in common is they are very adamant about not compromising. And so it is very important for those individuals that their respective team not give an inch. And so when you have that kind of dynamic, and both of those groups are kind of, I think, in the ascendancy in both parties. And so when you have that kind of dynamic, it does make it much harder to identify those issues where actually you can get 70% of Americans to have pretty similar views because that involves compromise. No one's going to get the perfect outcome in that kind of for those issues, and that's, you know, cuts across a number of issues that I'm happy to talk about more in depth. But it's the dynamic about those two kind of more extreme ends and the importance they place on not compromising.
Well, first of all, that's a very scary finding, you know, because exactly what you say is true. If we can't compromise, where do we go? But how about something like something that we agree on, like background checks? We know that 80%, with all the recent gun violence, this has become an important issue again. It's in the headlines. And we know that 80% of Americans agree on background checks, and even a majority of gun owners. I don't know if it's as high as 80%, but the vast majority of gun owners. So why is it that we can't find a common ground on something like background checks? Do you have any? I mean, I know that's a complicated question, and it's, you can't give a simple answer to that. But do you have any insight on that?
So I think that there's a short term and a long term dynamic that we have to stress here. So in the short term, you know, that's a political question, and then you get into kind of what are the incentives for specific representatives and senators, and what is the you know, support for a given, you know, whether it's background checks or whether it's another kind of bill, like what's the support in their specific district or state. And I think you also have, and this is what our studies show this in the U.S., I mean, right now there is a very strong, what we call kind of a tribal mentality, where if you are either a Democrat, if you're someone who identifies strongly as a Democrat or Republican, and this is broader than those two extremes I just described, part of your identity is about opposing ideas put forth by the other side. So I think that that's also a short-term dynamic of where bills may or may not move, even where you have lots of support, simply because we are in a moment when to give any ground is to signal weakness to people that you need for your party's support, or you perceive them to have the power within your party. I think longer term, it's a slightly different kind of dynamic. And this is where the research we do really tries to focus, because take something like gun control or gun rights. And we are, as we look to 2020, we're actually building our research agenda, and we're trying to get even more in depth into what are the principles that we should follow to try and help groups find common ground on issues like gun control, because our sense is there's a need to speak to individuals. So, for example, if you're talking to a person who is a very strong Second Amendment proponent, our research kind of indicates that you shouldn't come right in with a conversation about gun control or guns, because you actually need to demonstrate that you understand and in some ways affirm the underlying concern that they have, which is more for stability, for protection of their family in some sense. And so there's a whole subset of psychological values that we're trying to get a better sense for of how can we help people avoid antagonizing one another, because in the long term, I think that's how you change. You make people feel as if the idea is very congruent with their own personal framework, and that's where you can see issues like gun control, issues like immigration, very complex, hard issues. When people feel as if the proposition represents their values, they're going to support it because it's intuitive to them.
Well, and that's really the crux of the issue. You know, again, it bothers me to see us stand up, and I speak as a Democrat because that's who I am. So that's what I understand. Yep. And, you know, it bothers me to see people stand up and say resist, you know, that's really our mantra, right, as liberal Democrats, resist what's going on. And I just don't see any hope in making great progress if our methodology is just to resist. Or I've got to tell you, I just read Hillary Clinton's book, and it's entitled What Happened? You know, and that really struck me to say what happened. What happened is we lost, you know, and it seems to me that we're implying when we say something like that, that we really shouldn't have lost. So there was some aberration, something happened that, you know, in the cosmos, the stars didn't align or whatever was supposed to happen. And it wasn't anything we did. It was just a bad circumstance. And I think that's bad for us, that we need to take responsibility and that we need to try to build a consensus. So let me just ask you this. I went to India, where I participated in the 2019 Indian Resilience Conference. It just happened last, the Indian Resilience Summit of 2019 just happened last week, as a matter of fact, just got back on Tuesday. And one of the major issues that we talked about was education. So what do you think we need to do? How do we educate people so that we can bring them around to the kind of understanding that you're talking about? Do you see education as a key component?
So absolutely. I think education is, I used to work in education, so it's very near and dear to my heart, and actually spent a brief period of time in the D.C. education system. So it's very important. I will say that we can't assume that education is the only arena that is going to make the difference, because I think that we as adults, the adults in America right now, and that means anybody, 18 all the way to, whatever age someone is, we also have an obligation to try and make the situation better. And I'll point to two findings that I think are encouraging with respect to how do we make this happen. The first is that something like 2/3 of Americans don't want to come together, want to prioritize finding common ground, seeing the best in each other, and kind of unifying as Americans. It's a very, we found that, other groups who do polling have found that. So there is this very strong urge within a majority of Americans across party lines to try and find common ground. Again, why isn't that happening now? I think has a lot to do with short-term political dynamics, but that's out there. So I think that it gives space for leaders at every level and across institutions to start speaking to that desire to come together. And the second is there is a significant issue in America around what researchers and scientists call false polarization, which is the belief that we are more divided than we are. And that gets to a lot of what I think as adults, we can start dispelling myths about how extreme other Americans are. On both parties, we did a study, we released a report this summer called Perception Gap, How False Impressions Are Pulling Americans Apart. And we found that across Americans, there's a pretty distinct over-exaggeration of how extreme they think people of the other party are, and that they think that other party hold much more extreme views than actually they do in practice. So part of this is just getting more people who are kind of moderate to get their voices to be louder. Because once you start to dispel these myths that are very strong in people's minds, the space for common ground becomes much more evident, and people can move towards that, I think, much more easily than if they think the other side is an extreme group that they need to stop.
Well, let me ask you, how do we get people to trust each other? Isn't that a big factor in this, that one of the reasons we're polarized is we just don't trust the other side?
Yeah, so I think trust is central. I think it's tricky. I think what we find is that people actually still have a lot of trust for other Americans in certain capacities. So the military, for example, very high levels of trust. Your local teacher, very high levels of trust. Your local there's lots of trust in your local community, typically. That's not universally true. But where we see profound distrust is in institutions, so media, government, and in political parties. Both political parties, complete kind of collapse in trust. So I think there is a real challenge that we face, and that we need some of those institutions to change how they present themselves. And I think that the media comes to mind as one space where I think the lack of trust is the most concerning in some ways, because, and I'm sure you've talked about this in many different forums, but if all of us can find our own echo chambers and we all think that we're hearing truth, then anybody who has a different opinion or a different truth, in this case, I can't trust them. I can't trust anybody like them. And so we're never going to get to that kind of broad level of faith in other Americans so long as we have these kind of echo chambers feeding us exaggerated opinions and amplifying the most divisive voices in our society.
Well, I think that's one problem with the internet. I don't care what your opinion is on anything. You can find somebody on the internet that agrees with you. You know, I mean, it can mm-hmm. be the most bizarre, right? There's some groups out there that no matter what you believe, you can find others like you. And I think that validates people in their feelings of distrust in one another. And, you know, I just think that's terrible. And I wonder if you have any insight into what has changed in America, because, you know, when I was a kid, long as my children would say 100 years ago, there was a sense of being an American. You know what I mean? No matter what your position was on any particular issue, there was this thing that we all had in common, that we thought America was a great place, and it was kind of like people from the outside could criticize us, but you couldn't criticize us from the inside, right? Like, you know, you can criticize your own family, but you can't stand it when other people do it. There was that kind of sentiment that I don't see anymore, or as much anymore anyway. Do you have any insight on what's gone on in the past 50 years which has changed that?
So, sorry, that last part didn't quite come through, but I think
what has changed in America that's led us to this point where we're so divided?
Okay. So what we have found to be true, and we've done more in common globally, has studied U.S., U.K., France, Germany, Netherlands, Greece, and Italy. And we're actually in the midst of finalizing two new, very large studies in France and Germany. And I think that we do have to step back sometimes and recognize that the past, whether you say 15 years, 20 years, 25 years, have witnessed some profound macro changes and kind of earthquakes that we do see kind of rippling across our society still today. And I think, you know, top of mind is the financial crisis of 2008, which rippled through Europe and led to the sovereign debt crisis and had all kinds of consequences for a number of years. But for millions of Americans, I mean, they effectively were knocked sideways or knocked completely down and have not really ever recovered. And so that anxiety, the natural anxiety that that produces about financial security, financial stability, it affects, you know, so I graduated from West Point in 2007, kind of my generation went straight out of school into the recession. So it affected all of my generation. It also affected our parents, people who were co-signing for college loans, people who were co-signing for mortgages and, you know, trying to support all of their loved ones. And I think so that kind of macro anxiety is still very much with us. And so I think that people are in a heightened state of sense of threat and fear that something is going to take away the level of stability and security they have right now. The second major kind of revolution, I would say, is, to your point, social media and the internet, right? So extreme voices can find an outlet that previously would have been very difficult. And simultaneously, we are being continuously kind of boxed into much more narrow media chambers where we get to pick what we want to see as truth and what we want to hear. So I think that when we think about what has changed relative to, say, you know, 50 years ago, or even I think it's more recently, I do think we need to appreciate that there are some very powerful kind of earthquake seismic events that have happened in the past 20 years that are really causing individuals to experience life with a lot of anxiety and a lot of concern and with a lot less shared experiences. And that's in the U.S., this is different. This is special and unique to the U.S. We do see a very strong degree of geographic sorting. So Democrats live in cities and they live near other Democrats. You know, Republicans live much more kind of distributed across the country, but when you get into certain more rural or kind of mountain states, much more heavier concentration of people who identify as Republicans. So that the probability that you have friends, strong friends, who are of the different political party continues to decrease. And so that is also a significant challenge, because that's a harder problem to solve, because individuals are choosing to move to these locations for a lot of complex reasons.
Well, I must say, on to your second point about social media, you know, I've always felt that people really don't seek out the truth. I think they seek out reinforcement for the beliefs they already have. You know, they go out and they search for validation of what they feel. And as far as, you know, I think you make a very important point about geography, because when I was at the Democratic Committee, we used a thing called Claritas, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, but Claritas divides the country into 40 neighborhoods, 40 different types of neighborhoods, which are found everywhere. But we found that which you feel politically is more dependent on where you live than any other factor. So we used to use that to sort out likely contributors, for example. And once we got one, you know, the one I remember is Furs and Station Wagons was one neighborhood. And if we tried Furs and Station Wagons and it worked for us, then we would choose all the other Furs and Station Wagon neighborhoods in the country and mail to them. So we really found that to be true in the Democratic Party. We have a caller, Anise Jenkins, I think, is calling in. Anise, are you out there? An old friend of the show. Anise.
I'm here.
Yeah, what do you have
Hi,
to say?
Hi, Senator Brown.
A question for Dan?
Yes, I did. I wanted to know if maybe you've already talked about this, but is this division within the country connected to race at all? And the discussion of slavery seems to be coming up almost daily now about reparations, slavery. How much is race involved in this?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it is everywhere, I would say, in the division that we study in the U.S. So race, and again, More in Common has done national studies in a whole host of democracies. Race is a factor in the U.S. to a degree that is different and important relative to the other countries we've studied. And so I don't want to assign it a specific number, but I would say at almost every level, race is absolutely part of the landscape in the U.S., and it is, in any conversation about what is dividing us, I mean, race has to be part of the equation, I think. You know, it's interesting, though, I will say that we did find that, you know, something like 8 out of 10 Americans, 7 out of 10 Americans agree and acknowledge that racism is still a problem of significant degree in America. It's when you push and you get into, okay, so what do we do about it? That's when you start to see very diverse opinions, and it breaks down pretty significantly.
It's really interesting because when I tell my friends, I'm an African-American woman, I'm a black woman. Mm-hmm. When I tell my friends that my father, who was much older and, you know, he served in the military in World War II, I believe, he was a Republican. He liked Ike, and that's why he was a Republican. And it's very difficult for a lot of black people to understand that Republicans were, Republicanism was well known in the black community at one time.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, Anish, you know this very well, that Frederick Douglass was a Republican. You know, a lot of African Americans were Republicans because Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, you know, and for many years. And you might have to help me here, Anish. There was somebody that was involved in the statehood movement, Jack Kemp. And Jack Kemp, one of the reasons he was a Republican, and one of the reasons he was involved with the statehood movement is he used to tell us, or voting rights, actually, he was a voting rights guy, not a statehood guy, but he said one of the problems is that he wanted to get black people back in the Republican Party, that they had left the Republican Party in droves, and he remembered a time when they were there. So let me ask you, Dan, do Republicans have to change the issues to get black people back in their party, do you think? Or do you have any insight on that?
So we do. We did polling on this specifically. We asked Democrats kind of what percentage of Republicans do you think believe racism to be a significant problem today in America? And Democrats said they estimated about 51% of Republicans would say that racism is a significant problem. We then polled Republicans, and actually 79% of Republicans said racism is a problem. So I think that when we talk, I mean, again, this gets to it's obviously a very complex and difficult conversation, but I do want to underscore that there are lots of individuals who identify as Republicans who acknowledge and who are very aware of racism as a significant problem. Now, we can step back and be like, how do their current politics, I think in some ways, again, it's a slightly, we can view that through a different set of analytics, but I think at the underlying level, there is still a broad swath of both parties who do understand the challenges that racism presents for our country.
And isn't that spreading more and more? We certainly, I think, see an element of racism in Brexit. I was just in India, and they have a leader, Mr. Modi, and he just took statehood away from Kashmir, which is have been a state for many, many years because it's primarily Muslim, and he wants to make India a Hindu-based government. So are we seeing more and more of this in the world, or are we just uncovering it more, do you think?
No, I think we are seeing more and more. More in Common was actually launched primarily to study why we saw rising authoritarianism in, you know, this, especially we launched in Europe, in the 2015, 2016 in response to the migrant crisis. So Warren Common has been studying this phenomenon for a long time, and we definitely see a disturbing growth in authoritarian tendencies. And this is kind of, you know, true across the board in lots of different countries. We can go to Turkey, we can go to lots of different places. A distinctive approach by authoritarian parties or leaders to identify a very clear other and, you know, position the other as the cause of all of the country's problems. So I think, you know, this rising level of and is very, very, I think, disturbing. And I think something that the U.S. needs to take a lead against. But also, we need many more countries to kind of to stand up. And we saw some, there's some been some encouraging signs. I mean, Italy, for example, we just had the most extreme kind of Salvini did not get pulled into government, and they formed a more moderate government recently. So there are some encouraging bright spots out there, but they are against a backdrop of much more worrying trends.
And again, isn't education important here? That we mm-hmm. I mean, don't we find that is there a correlation between people that are less educated and more racist? Do you know that?
I don't want to speak. I would need to look at the data to get kind of a hard answer. I mean, I think I don't think it's a simple kind of binary relationship where, you know, one is associated profoundly more with the other. I mean, certainly we've seen, I mean, in some of the more nativist, racist language that came out of some of the European parties in the last several years, I mean, those were led by individuals who are extremely well educated and are intentionally choosing to utilize race or ethnicity as a vehicle to other communities.
Well, it's certainly one of the oldest political tracks, right? I'm sorry, Anish, go ahead. Do you have another question?
Oh, I'm sorry. Do you think we would have Trump as president if we hadn't had Obama before Trump, a black president before Trump?
That's interesting. If you're asking me that question, I find that very interesting, and I don't know. I don't know. I guess we'll have to wait on, you know, history to really give us perspective on that. I worked for Jimmy Carter, as you might know, and I would, you know, be the first to say that if it hadn't been for Richard Nixon, you wouldn't have had Jimmy Carter, you know. Maybe there is a connection there. I don't know. Do you want to venture a guess at that, Dan?
Certainly, it's a really interesting question. I don't know. I think is the answer I'd have to go with.
I think it's a very interesting question, Anish. But unfortunately, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if it's how much backlash there was. It's hard to say. I think the Democrats put up a candidate that people didn't want. I think more than anything, that's the way history will record it. But, you know, and Obama is still wildly popular in all the opinion polls that you see out there. You know, if it weren't for the ban on, you know, president only serving two terms, he might be able to run again. And when he's very popular. So I don't know, but I think it's a very interesting question. And as always, thanks for calling in.
Thank you so much.
Let's move on to the other ism, Dan, because that's what we talked about a lot. A lot of the 2019 Indian Resilience Conference focused on women and the importance of women and the importance of empowering women. What do you have to say on that issue? That you know, there seemed to be consensus in the groups that I was involved in, that one of the things that we need to do to build resilience in communities, especially in the third world, is to empower women.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I think one of the proudest moments I had in Afghanistan was my unit helped provide security for the first graduation of women officers into the Afghan army. And I think that that country is a pretty amazing example of a lot of ways of what, and again, lots of right. ground to remains to go there, but women have, I think, had significantly more opportunities opened up to them subsequent to the removal of the Taliban in 2001, 2002. And you've seen women leading on so many fronts, improving literacy, improving the quality of the environment, improving job opportunities, improving a whole host of factors. So I think absolutely that the proof is out there, particularly when women are empowered, it leads to kind of transformational results.
Well, you know, I think that's one thing that was brought up many, many times in this conference that I went to, is that when you empower women and when you give women economic resources, they tend to invest more back in the community. Your investment, you know, I think many people that were there made the argument, and they were from all over. They were from China and Europe and all over Asia. I think that the sentiment there was that women are a really good investment when it comes to resilience. They really help build the community in many positive ways. Let me ask you, how have you been received? How has More in Common been received? Are people open to this and saying, yay, let's, you know, because this is the way I feel. I feel like, God bless you for doing this. What kind of reception are you getting from people?
No, it's a great – so we were very fortunate to have gotten a very welcoming reception in the U.S. and in all the countries we work in. In France, for example, we are a very strong partner with the French Catholic Church on how do you build strong communities that include Catholics and recent migrants and Muslim communities within France. In the U.S., we've had a very, very warm response. I think that the Hidden Tribes report that we published in 2018 has now been kind of circulated across something like 750 to 800 articles across the country, and it's been a topic of conversation for a lot of different communities. So it's exciting to see the appetite and I think the interest from all quarters of the country. I think it is important to also note that we've seen a really strong appetite for actionable steps in communities, individuals, institutions can take to try and bridge some of these divisions. And so we're very fortunate to work with a lot of really wonderful groups. I'll name a couple that I think are doing really amazing work. There's a group called One America, which they run chapters across the country where they intentionally bring together people from different backgrounds and ideologies. They are based in places of faith, you know, so temples, mosques, churches. And they intentionally bring people together across lines of difference to then work on specific projects of improving their community, building a stronger shared identity. So they are doing amazing work across the country. There's another group, Cities of Service, which, you know, they do a very similar kind of work in cities, where how can you get communities to come together to try and beautify their block or to try and build a new, playground for the local kids. And it's intentionally trying to bring those communities together who don't normally or naturally share the same playground, right? And there's really, I think, we're seeing a lot of increased activity on this front. So even, you know, in D.C., the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, you know, a longstanding D.C. kind mm-hmm. of actor, they've taken it upon themselves and they're launching initiatives to just go out and talk to people about how do we come together as a country. So even though, you know, their primary focus is budget and fiscal issues, they think that the need for unity is such an important priority right now that they're making it a part of their work. And we see other D.C. institutions and institutions across the country starting to do more and more of that as people realize that, one, we can't continue this level of division. It impedes our progress on everything. And two, that there actually is an appetite. Once you talk to people at the community level, you can get people to follow into, you know, a town hall, into a picnic or a community event, because they really want to feel more connected to other Americans.
Well, you know, when I've been traveling internationally, besides this thing in India, I also go to a similar symposium in Portugal every year. I've been a keynote speaker a couple of years. And I think internationally, people are realizing how important this is because of some of the problems that we face, like global climate change. I think that people are starting, you know, all over the globe are saying, look, none of us can solve global climate change alone. The only hope that we have to save the planet in that regard is to come together and cooperate. So when you talk about actionable steps, are there specific steps that your organization recommends?
Yes, absolutely. Yep. So the first thing as individuals that we all can do, and this gets to what you were talking about earlier, Senator Brown, is we can diversify the media that we consume. So if you are a Democrat and you are someone who considers that a big part of your identity, it's actually probably important to try and go on to conservative news sites or conservative media outlets and just check in to see how they are describing certain issues. We found in our research that actually helps, and the same is true if you're a Republican, go and, you know, watch a more liberal-oriented news program or news site. We found that that actually produces a much more accurate understanding of the other political party than if you were to just consume your normal kind of left or right-leaning media sources. So that's one thing that we as individuals can all do. The second, and this is, I think, hard because people have a lot of competing demands for their time, but really it's also, we did a study of people's social circles, and we also found that, particularly for Democrats, but true across the board, too often individuals don't have people in their social circles, in their close social circles, that have a different political ideology. And so again, these are, if you can go out and find individuals that you can have a conversation with on a regular basis, and that's what these groups like One America do, they enable folks to come together, you tend to discover that actually the opinions they hold are not as extreme, and you start to have a slightly different framework when you think about what do Republicans stand for or what do Democrats stand for. So trying to broaden and diversify on an ideological scale your social circle is also something that we recommend. And the third recommendation is, this is less for individuals, but we recommend that institutions, whatever your focus area is, start to make common ground a priority. And so I mentioned how the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget is doing that. This is really important. I think any organization, whether it's a labor union, a private sector business, a church, a temple, a mosque, a YMCA or a gym, if you're not making common ground a priority for your organization, again, we're going to continue to see the kind of division that none of us actually want. And that causes real problems. I mean, you alluded to climate change. There's all kinds of challenges that we actually really have to work together because they literally threaten our livelihood. And so whatever your issue area is, we really still make finding common ground a priority. And we're happy as an organization to help you figure that out and to build toolkits and resources for your community to say, how can we make finding common ground a priority for our group?
You know, I can't emphasize how important I think that is. As I told you when we started, this was the basis for this show. And so we have Maria. Unfortunately, Maria is not with us tonight, but Maria is a Republican woman from the West Coast. And I'm obviously a Democratic man from the East Coast. And the idea was that we could come together and talk about issues in kind of a civilized way. And what we found out, what Maria and I found out, that even though we're from different parties and different perspectives, we have more in common than what separates us. And I think the more that people come together, the more they'll understand that. So tell me, give me a website that people can go to or, you know, how they can reach out to you to get information.
Yeah, absolutely. So the website they should go to is hiddentribes.us. Hiddentribes.us. That's our main U.S.-facing website. You can see all the research we've done. You can contact all of our team. You can, you know, find us on social media, all that kind of stuff. But that's a good place to start because, to your point about the importance of education, we do our best to try and publicize. You know, we're a nonprofit. We try and make everything we do public and get it out there so people can read it, can digest it, can see how it applies to their lives. And then if you're interested in taking more action, you know, again, happy to reach out to us, and we are happy to make those connections happen.
Well, you know, I just think your organization, especially the name, More in Common, it just hits the nail right on the head. I think that this is really what America has. We have more in common with each other than that which separates us. And I think that when we sit down and talk, we find out that's true. And, you know, what I do when I think about Republicans, I try to think about the Republicans that I know and I care about. You know, I think we all have those moments where we hear something that enrages us from the other side. But what I always try to think of, and I think this is a good tool, is, I mean, there are people in my family that I love that are Republicans. So the idea that we seem to have come up with in our divided society that Republicans are all bad, or Democrats are all bad, or liberals are all bad, or conservatives are all bad, it's just crazy. And so, I try to put it as much as I can on an individual level. So I think what you have to say is very true. And tell me, Dan, what do you want to say? What question haven't I asked you? What is it that you want to add that we haven't discussed?
Well, before I even get to a question, I just wanted to echo what you just said. And I think, you know, so I do this work. I'm very thankful to be part of the More in Common team. But what drew me to this work was really serving in the Army. And yes. So I have, like you said, friends that I love across the political spectrum, people who are independents, who don't, you know, people who are Republican, people who are Democrats. I've lived in communities that are liberal, that are, you know, conservative, and in all of those instances found really warm, welcoming, you know, neighbors and families. So that's who I think about when I think about politics. And I know through my own experience that there is that common ground. There is, again, we all want what's best for our kids. We want what's right. best for our neighbors' kids. And so I appreciate you saying that. I think that that's also something that I think hopefully more people will start verbalizing, actually, is, you know, this is when I think of a Democrat, this is who I imagine, someone that I love, not somebody that I see on TV. And the same thing goes when, you know, someone thinks of Republicans. So so I think the point that I think we would be great to drill in a little bit more is, why, you know, I think one of the things that we think about is identity and the importance of identity. And I think that before we close up the show, one thing I just want to highlight from our research is that, and this is, you know, we build on really cutting edge but very solid behavioral psychology and social science. And, you know, increasingly science is telling us how we don't have just one identity, right? We all carry with us many identities. You know, I'm a husband, I'm a son, I'm a brother, I am a veteran, I am a many different identities. When people feel threatened, and this has been verified in lots of different studies, when people feel a heightened sense of threat, they close down on the identity that they feel the strongest sense of protection from. And so we can see how that dynamic. And I mentioned some of the reasons why, you know, people are scared for their jobs, they're scared for their security in lots of instances across the country. You can see how when people feel a heightened level of threat, they start to retrench, and it's much more difficult to find common ground with someone who has a very different identity if you feel threatened, because you want to, your body, our genetics, our evolutionary science tells us that we want to be with other people that we feel we're going to be protected by. And so I do think that, again, one just high-level thing that we all can do is when we see, like you said, if something makes us upset, rather than responding in kind and being angry and being loud, if you can de-escalate situations, if you can take a second and cool the temperature down, it's much more likely that you will actually have a productive conversation. And if you respond with an intensity that mirrors whatever it is you just saw, there's no way that you're ever going to connect with that person, because both of you are starting to retrench into the, whatever that identity is, and that doesn't overlap. So we try and talk about this when we do workshops, when we do trainings, we try and highlight how can we figure out ways to reduce perceptions of threat so that way individuals feel more likely to welcome others into their identity and to connect with folks. So whatever, I think that there's lots of different actors and institutions that can utilize that research and findings to try and change how they engage with communities that have different backgrounds.
Well, and you know what? That's what politicians do all the time. They try to plug into your identity right away. So if you're speaking to a crowd and you're a veteran, that's one of the first things you say, because you want to relate to all the other veterans. You want all the other veterans in the audience to feel connected. I'm a former Teamster. I say it all the time. I say, I stand up. I was a Teamster for a year or so, but I've always used union. I ran a business for 25 years where I used union labor only. And I always say that because I want all the union people out there to connect, to say, oh, this is a good guy. He's one of us. He's a member of a union. And I think we all have that in common. Those things in common, right? The things that you mentioned, a brother, husband, father, we all love our children, right? So that's very important. And my particular issue, which you probably know about, Dan, to make the District of Columbia whole by making a state, that is a partisan issue. It's the ultimate partisan issue. 80% of America believes that we should have the same rights, but we're separated by the division, the divisiveness that's going on in the country. So organizations like yours, Dan Bellone, are a bright spot in our future. And I thank you so much for doing that. And I thank you for being on our show. We're running out of time here. Can you give us the website one more time so that our listeners can plug in if they want?
Sure. It's hiddentribes.us. Hiddentribes.us.
And I hope that people... go ahead.
No, I was just going to say thank you for having me on, Senator Brown, and I really appreciated our conversation. And I thank you for highlighting the importance of finding common ground, and that we all can do more as individuals to actually make that a priority in our lives. So it's been great to be part of the show today.
Yeah, thank you so much for being on, Dan. And I hope you'll come back in the future and let us know how you're doing, and let us know if you come up with that aha moment where you can relieve the divisiveness in our society. That would be great. And really, I admire you for your service to our country, and also your continued effort to make America a better place for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we're going to leave you tonight. Thanks, Dan. We're going to leave you tonight with a song in honor of our guest. Since I'm an old hippie, this is a song from The Police called One World Is Enough. So we'll see you next week, folks. And thanks so much for tuning in. And thank you, Dan Bellone, and the people at More in Common. See you next week.
Give the people their right to vote.